Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. From Samuel Pepys to Sir Henry Chips Channon, Tony Benn, Alan Clark, and even Sacha Swire, political diarists are often credited with providing valuable or at least entertaining insights into the political world they inhabit and observe. But are the best diarists really those who are secondary figures in the events they describe, and how many of them actually provide meaningful substance to our understanding of past events? In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Back talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about the craft and value of the political diarist.
Professor Jeremy Black, when many people think about political diaries, they will perhaps start with the 17th century and with Samuel Pepys. Was diary keeping a preoccupation of people before the 17th century, or was it something that developed at that time, perhaps because Protestants weren't going to confession anymore?
I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, you could argue that diaries go a long way back in the practice of chroniclers, and you could argue that a chronicler, in effect, is a diarist of his time. He might not be taking a daily note, but that the whole organisation of time is sequential, and that that was the standard way, in many senses, of recording the history of institutions or the history of people. So you might record the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle as a form of diary, or Orderic Vitalis and others commenting on sort of 11th, 12th century the Anglo-Norman aristocracy. You could argue that they're diarists of a form. I mean, as so often, people who think that the last quarter millennium or 300 or 400 years sort of invented something. I mean, I'm recently noticing the new books come out on constitutions and being very favourably reviewed, and it's by the excellent historian Linda Colley, and all credit to her. But of course, constitutions have a long history prior to the period she's writing about, and one can think of medieval ones. But anyway, let us press on.
So, before the 17th century, are there politicians who wrote diaries in the way we would understand them now, as a personal record, and when would that time have started, when they started to be published rather than just as something for private pleasure?
Pepys wasn't, of course, published in his lifetime. I mean, I think one's got a whole set. I mean, we're clearly, you would like to discuss the more modern period, and I can understand this. But what I was going to say is we've got a whole set of suppositions as to what a diary is, which we have to handle with some care. For example, if you were sending regular letters from place A to place B detailing what was going on and your comments about it, that in effect was a diary, even if it may not take the form of what we would consider a diary today. So I remember publishing an article and using the papers of a mid-18th century MP called Tucker, who'd left his letters to his brother, and they're in manuscript in the Bodleian, and he wrote frequently during the parliamentary session, and indeed outside the parliamentary session, and he had clearly a close relationship with his brother. You could argue that is a form of diary. It takes the form of letters, but of course, as you will know, the epistolary form in the 18th century, and indeed earlier, brings together the overlap of genres we might now, and forms we might now treat as separate. But let us take your question. You're obviously interested in the modern form of political diary. As an 18th centuryist, I mean, you know, Pepys is all very well, but if you want to think of 18th century works, you can think of somebody at a much more exalted social rank than Pepys. You can think of John Lord Harvey for the 1730s, or you can think later in the 18th century for Horace Walpole, fourth Earl of Orford, and obviously prior to that a Member of Parliament, the son of a Prime Minister, although, I mean, he was acknowledged as the son. In fact, Charles Churchill was probably the father. These are people of far socially and been politically more important than, you know, some parvenu like Chips Channon.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? We're going to come to 20th century political diarists shortly, but just on our route to there, I mean, most of the, certainly the published volumes of 18th and 19th century politicians, it tends to be their correspondence that gets published.
He left edited by R.R. Sedgwick, came out in the late 20s. I understand that Stephen Taylor's doing a new edition for Yale. Those weren't letters. I mean, there are separate letters that Lord Harvey wrote. It was a form of diary covering his period as a courtier and politician in the 1730s. He was a close confidant of the Queen. He obviously was a political figure, member of Parliament. Then, I think he ended up as Lord Privy Seal. I mean, you know, a man of consequence, an intimate of Sir Robert Walpole's, the Prime Minister. By intimate, I mean political intimate, not sexual intimate. And he knew everybody and was at a very senior level, indeed. And, you know, as you will probably know, there's quite extensive discussion. I mean, I did a biography of George II as to whether Harvey's unsympathetic account of George II, how realistic it is. Then with Horace Walpole, there is the enormous and great addition. Now, a lot of that is the correspondence edited by W.S. Lewis, but there are also the four volumes of his diary on George II and his period, and three volumes on George III, or I might have got that the wrong way around. But there's seven volumes. These are enormous works of great scholarship and erudition, the editions. And, you know, I mean, Horace Walpole was somebody who counted. Now, again, there is extensive scholarly discussion about the veracity of these. And by veracity, I don't mean that when he was talking about a parliamentary debate, it didn't occur and he didn't manage to get it right. And often his source is the best. What I mean is, in particular, his portrayal of George III. And again, scholarship is very great. I mean, what is interesting is a lot of people look at modern political diaries and think, oh, well, things have got better and the scholarship has got better. Actually, I would say the reverse. I would say the scholarship on the 18th century diaries is long established and of a very high quality indeed. I want to add, I haven't edited any of them. I twice had unpublished diaries that I had the opportunity to edit, and I just decided I'd rather write on other things, and they remain unedited. But these are important works by serious and senior people. And just to remind you, I mean, Horace Walpole, who again knew everybody, Horace Walpole was again not just a political figure of note, but also an aesthete, Strawberry Hill, of course, the early British or English neo-Gothic, and also wrote the first and most famous in many senses of the neo-Gothic novels, The Castle of Otranto. Harvey himself, who I've already mentioned, he wrote extensively political pamphlets, he wrote a play. I mean, you know, these were people of consequence. Go into the 19th century, exactly the same. There's an excellent edition by John Vincent of the Derby Diary. Mm. And again, I mean, one of the interesting points is that many of the people who are diarists who've been commented on most recently, I mean, I heard the launch of the Simon Heather's excellent edition. It's a very scholarly work. He's a very distinguished and brilliant historian, and he and Michael Gove were talking about it, and they were discussing the idea that maybe it's only second rankers who write political diaries, and they were citing Sacha Squire and James Cannon. Well, neither of those were even second raters, but I would say the exact opposite, that most of the, you know, you have had some really important people write diaries, and it's worth thinking about that, and it's worth thinking about how much attention it's worth devoting to people who are relatively inconsequential.
Well, I'm very interested you raise that point, because it is often said that, you know, the best diarists are the second or third raters, who are observers of the scene rather than the shapers of policy. Of those key players who wrote political diaries, which are the ones that you rate particularly highly, both in terms of their historical veracity and in what they uncover about the personalities themselves?
Well, can I just say, that's again, you've just raised a very interesting question, which is, what are we as readers or as historians or as commentators going to be interested in? I mean, I'm not particularly interested in somebody making a comment as to whether Rudyard Kipling to them looked dirty. I mean, that to me is a complete inconsequence. If you are, as an historian, interested in why things happened, then you really want the sources of the people who made the decisions. Now, as I've mentioned, their diary may take a whole host of different fashions. It may be of the form of a correspondence, and you know, you shouldn't think of it, and it may never have been intended as publication. Well, that ends the last point. Brings up a whole host of other factors. Is a diary that was intended for publication worthy of attention? Because after all, it was clearly a formulated work with that objective. And I first came across this years ago when I was working in the early 1980s. One of my books, although it didn't come out until I think 86 or 87, was A History of the Grand Tour, and I've done three others on other aspects of the Grand Tour since. Now, as you will know, the standard sources frequently used by historians, most of whom are, or shall we say, literary scholars more than historians, are diaries and journals of the Grand Tour. But these works were, on the whole, intended for publication. And, you know, whether they're, for example, multi-volume spleen or whatever form they're designed to take, those are less interesting, in my view, than works that were produced of, you know, whatever form, that were not intended for publication. And I focused in all my four books on the Grand Tour and in a number of articles and essays on the latter case. Now, you've always got to be careful. Some letters were intended to be handed around. But on the whole, letters were not. And on top of that, there are many journals of the Grand Tour that were never published and quite clearly were never intended for publication. And in my mind, they tell you much more about the Grand Tour than they do about the tourist as poseur. Now, often a diarist intending for publication is a poseur. They may or may not be of interest in that light. I personally, life's short, I haven't got time to waste on these people. But they may be of interest in that light to some, but they will definitely not necessarily tell you about what they are encountering and will tend to focus on waspish remarks about people or institutions without necessarily understanding or making any understanding of them, precisely because, as you've already suggested, these were outsiders.
When did some of these diaries, reflections, correspondence, you talked about them being published, how long after the event were they published?
Well, that's again a good question. There is a big difference, as I pointed out in one of my books. I think I actually wrote it. No, I put an essay in Archives I wrote on the Grand Tour sources, so you'd have to go to Archives. And I distinguished there between diaries published in one's lifetime, or journals, whatever form you want to call them, and those published subsequently, which had clearly not been intended for publication. The latter category is of value and deserves scholarly attention. The former value is a form of literature. Now, there's nothing wrong with literature, but you have to understand it as literature, not as a revelation as to what was going on. It's a revelation as to what often, in the case of the 18th century, with people like Smollett, who were desperately concerned to make money, it was an idea of what was thought would sell. And, I mean, you've got to bear this in mind. A diary that is published and an edition that is published are often intended primarily as commercial products. Nothing wrong with that at all. But they should be seen as commercial products and not, as it were, works that have sprung through, as it were, you know, from the brow of Athena through some process of brilliant revelation.
Is this a British or an Anglosphere phenomenon, politicians writing diaries which are published, or is it common to humanity or political humanity, certainly throughout the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, I wouldn't say I could tell you about all countries. I certainly can think that in France, where the idea of the politician as man of letters, it usually was a man, but that was the case, was one that was relatively speedily developed from the 18th century, I would say. Obviously, you can go back earlier than that. I mean, there is the idea, going back to the classics, that as it were, a scholar politician should reflect on the world in which they are and write a form of history of it, a diary or journal being, as it were, interchangeable with that form of history. Now, of course, you know, it's very interesting because we see ourselves today pulled in two very different directions. There is the argument, is it accurate, i.e., is it a form of history, which is an interesting comment itself, because as you will know, in the 18th century, history was a term used, as with Tom Jones by Henry Fielding, for any work of a certain type, and is it something that reflects personality, i.e., how far does it capture our modern post-romantic idea of the revelation of soul almost through one's works. Now, those are all very well as tropes of writing and of analysis, but they're not necessarily define the entire process. And I think one has to be very careful. I deliberately started by mentioning the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is a long way from that woman Swire, but I've forgotten her name, but first name, but it's a long way from her. But the point I was trying to make is that you shouldn't assume that the modern form is necessarily, as it were, better, whatever you mean by better, than an older form. The notions of fitness for purpose come to the fore here, and the fitness for purpose at the present moment is clearly commercial appeal, and that is clearly linked to the way in which these things are sold. I mean, you must have seen the way in which, you know, that work was... I reviewed it for your magazine, The Critic,
yes.
But that work was pushed very actively in the Sunday supplements and all the rest of it, with the emphasis on raucous remarks made by David Cameron's circle. Whereas if you read the book in its entirety, as I made clear in my review, a lot of it is rather tedious and boring stuff about the prospect of Amber Rudd or Dominic Raab becoming Prime Minister, which just shows what a flawed analyst she was.
Yes, indeed. Well, one particularly golden period for political diaries in Britain is the 1930s and 40s, particularly, obviously, you've mentioned already Sir Henry Chipps Channon, but also Harold Nicholson, Alfred Duff Cooper, very interesting diaries as well. Can we say that this was, there was something particular about the 1930s? Maybe, you know, people starting to communicate more on telephone than by correspondence, so that these figures were keeping diaries?
Well, several things to say. I think the only joke in that dire work by E.H. Carr on history was the one where, writing about Spengler and the decline of the West, he commented that people started to believe in the decline of the West and they had to do their own washing up. He's writing about intellectuals. Now, the point is that the three men you mentioned, Chipps Channon, Nicholson and Cooper, never had to do their own washing up. So one of the requirements was leisure. But you can take it a stage further. How should one put it? None of these people were among the busy individuals of that age. Mm-hmm. None of them were actually tremendously talented. And in a way, writing in their diaries, and often sniping at the more talented and more active, was a way for them to try and establish their logic. mean, there are other forms of writing in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, which you could say are interesting, and including by busy people. I mean, it's very interesting, for example, that John Buchan, and for that matter Winston Churchill, wrote history books, just as in the 19th century all sorts of people, Darby for example, had written history books. It's interesting to, in other words, there are different ways to express one's perception of the world one is in. One of the ways to express that perception is by looking to the past and presenting the present as part of a continuation of the past, in which you try and extrapolate the issues of the today onto this broader canvas. Now, that's a very different form of expressing an ego, because obviously you're doing so in order to offer your perception, your interpretation. But it's certainly somewhat more significant than what some diarists write about. But also, I would say, and I go back to saying this, yes, you're right about the telephone, absolutely right, but the standard form in which people expressed themselves, people of note, in the 1930s, continued to be the letter. Letters were sent very frequently. They could actually be interchanged on the same day. The post was much more frequent. Postal collections and delivery is much more frequent than today. And the norm was often that you did so. So you go away, if you are wealthy, to a stately home, and, you know, there'd be time. People would, obviously there are some stately homes in which all the time is spent on drinking and sort of bed hopping. But a lot of people were sitting there writing lengthy letters about what was going on. And there's also the enormous way in which the institutionalization of life means that prominent individuals who are actually making decisions and considering them are able to use the records of that institution on top of their private correspondence in order to make comments, which are in a way more central. So, if you want to look at, let's say, the debate over appeasement, you could look at who says what to some party in Mayfair, or you could look, think about it, horror, at looking at the, the Imperial General Staff and the correspondence coming in or out of it. Or, for that matter, you can look at people who wrote journals or diaries or memoranda for themselves, which they never published, but which they didn't clearly intend as part of a long-range diary. I mean, I remember when I wrote a book on interwar military history, one of the people whose papers I examined was J.F.C. Fuller. And J.F.C. Fuller both wrote letters, but he also left one or two journals. I mean, his papers were extensively damaged in German bombing in World War II, but he did leave some journals which were not published. In a way, Fuller's had his strengths and his limitations, and I would think his limitations are more apparent than his strengths, in my view. But it would be absurd to pretend that he was less perceptive than on some of these matters than some of the individuals you might cite.
Well, another thought that is in my mind, whether we actually sometimes place, as historians, place too much emphasis on diaries, and the tendency of certainly some of the more waspish diarists to kind of pick up on throwaway remarks and gossip, which, people might make in an offhand way, but doesn't really reflect their genuine view. Is that a danger of focusing on these diaries?
I mean, on Shannon, the only real interest in Shannon is that he was close to Butler, because obviously he was served under him during the particular period of appeasement, and that is significant. It actually doesn't say much for Butler that he had Shannon there. So it would be really interesting, if you really wanted to assess him, it would be really interesting to see what you could find in the German and Italian archives, because Italian military intelligence is very good, their perception of him. That would be be interesting, and it would be interesting to see if you could find anything in the British intelligence archives. Other than that, a man really without any consequence. If you go back, I mean, I mentioned Horace Walpole. Well, I mean, you know, it's, if you really want to understand the politics of the 1750s, for example, or 40s, you're much better off looking at the regular correspondence between the Duke of Newcastle and Henry Pelham, his brother, or the Duke of Newcastle and his close friend, Lord Chancellor Hardwicke. These three men were the old core Whigs. They were the people, and their correspondence very free, you know, there's a lot of the correspondence survives, massive amounts of it in public archives. It will tell you a hell of a lot more than Horace Walpole's WASP initial, which is interesting. I mean, I've read it all, but it only takes you so far. Lord Harvey is a different question, because in the case of Lord Harvey on the 1730s, George II didn't write very much at all. Robert Walpole, the surviving correspondence, is mostly patronage requests, and a lot that Harvey writes about we don't have alternative sources for in terms of conversations at high political level, but that doesn't mean that Harvey is necessarily accurate. But precisely because we don't have the alternatives, he is more significant in a way than the 20th century diarists. If you move on to the post, I mean, it's interesting, the individuals you mentioned were all figures who were conservatives, and that's interesting itself, and reflects possibly upon a particular fascination that a subsequent generation had with their predecessors, or with that group. And it's worth considering what the situation will be in the post-1945 period. When you're saying to me, do we overrate diarists, I would say yes. I mean, if you think about it, the leading Labour figure whose paper survives, whose diary survives for the 1980s, is Anthony Wedgwood Benn. But I'm not sure that you would regard Wedgwood Benn as an individual who is, and he clearly, I mean, you know, he was a significant Labour figure, but I don't think he actually was one that you would wish to build your account of politics in the 1980s or for that matter, 70s around. And I have the same trouble with quite a few figures. The idea that because somebody is mentioning what somebody else might have said to them or about somebody else at a dinner party or so on, that is necessarily accurate. Well, I mean, you're a professional historian. You know that the great thing that we're all trained to do if we're professional historians is source criticism. The one thing diarists don't go in for is source criticism, because they go in for vanity. Very few diarists will say to you, will say in their writing, I can tell you this having read a lot of diaries, not by political diaries, very few will say, unfortunately, I didn't really understand what was going on in the political shenanigans of 2015 to 17. They're not going to say that, are they? What they are going to do is, you know, imply that because they met somebody maybe five times, they had an understanding of them. Well, there is a whole set of methodological and conceptual and historiographical flaws with that, some of which are absolutely hilarious. I mean, the idea that characters are necessary. The idea, for example, let's just see what's been going on yesterday. Are you going to write your history of the royal family around the diary or equivalent sources of the Duchess of Sussex, or for that matter, the Duke of Sussex? You might. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a terribly helpful approach to doing so. And again, I don't think it will be of much consequence. But, you know, no diarist wants to say, this is really not that important, and I am not that much of consequence. That's not what diarists do. But in practical terms, that is true of most historical accounts, that all that you can glimpse of is a fragment of the past, and and a fragment of the present, and the fraction of the present. And that ought to be the context within which diaries are understood. Doesn't mean they can't be interesting, but I'd rather read letters, actually. I think letters give you much more of a sense of spontaneity, and also letters are far less likely to be subsequently polished up.
Yes, well, amongst British front-rank politicians of the 20th century, the letters to his two sisters, Ida and Hilda, from Neville Chamberlain, is a real case of someone at the forefront of politics. I mean, he's Prime Minister at the time, and yet finding time to write in great detail, not tittle-tattle, but very detailed levels of information in his letters, which are of greater value to historians than the diary that that Chamberlain also kept, and which is interesting but more intermittent.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a very fair comment. And in a way, the intermittent quality or character of diaries is exactly what you would anticipate. And somebody who, let us say, on Sunday at the end of a busy week reflects on it might well provide a coherence that is misleading. Again, most people don't want to say, I was wrong on Tuesday in my reaction to the French ambassador when he told me about developments in Hungary. They don't want to say that, do they? Instead of, where it's much more interesting to find out what they'd written on Tuesday as a result, what memo they'd sent as a result of meeting the French ambassador.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, diaries obviously help enormously historians writing about a particular period and the kind of close personalities involved. But, I mean, to take some of your works, I mean, you've published extensively on different aspects of British history, but, you know, if you're writing a wide-scoping work like the History of Britain that you wrote, are diaries, political diaries, of much use to that, or really are they much too granular and personalised from which to draw broader perspectives?
Well, it depends what people... I mean, as with any source, it depends what you're looking for and what... I mean, how should one put it? First of all, it depends... With a diary or a letter or any other source, and I think we might go on and have a discussion on historical sources, there is the question of accuracy, there is the question of applicability. Now, those two questions require separate consideration. If you're going to use a historical document to clarify or to illuminate or to illustrate a general work, then you have to be aware of the problem of any specific example. So, you know, as you may know, I've taken part in a controversy as to whether there was an early modern military revolution. Principal other, as it were, for taking a different viewpoint, is a distinguished scholar called Geoffrey Parker. And each of us, I would like to think, have used examples that, I mean, obviously they support our cases, are valuable in themselves. The question is how far they contribute to the general conclusions and arguments that we've drawn from them. So the same could be made of British history. If you wish to argue, let us say, I've argued in my book on Britain since 1945 that the extent to which there was continuity in the 1960s and the extent to which there was still a significant amount of popular conservatism, and I've argued that's been underrated. And, you know, I would, you know, look at things like the number of people that took part in revivalist meetings, you know, Billy Graham, all the rest of it, I would argue that you shouldn't write everything around pop festivals. And I think that's a reasonable point of view, but how does one, if one is using a diary, demonstrate? You know, somebody could produce a diary in which the argument is made, 1968, it's all new, this is all radical, etc. Or somebody could produce a diary entry for 1968 in which they're describing that the impact for them as a train spotter of the movement away from steam to diesel has been the biggest change of the last few years. Both of those are actually accurate. In a way, if you're writing in that type, what you want to do, in my case, what I want to do is to open up readers to the flawed idea that there is a zeitgeist, the flawed idea that history is inevitably going, or even necessarily going, in one direction, and the view instead that there is a multiplicity of experiences and a multiplicity of opinions. So from my point of view, citing different accounts, whether they're diaries, letters, or any other form, is extraordinarily helpful. But obviously, it depends. I mean, I'm writing for intelligent, I'm speaking for intelligent listeners. Those listeners who want to have, let me all tell you all very simply, this is what is going on, and to give one account, sort of Simon Sharma approach to history, they should watch or read Simon Sharma. That's not the kind of audience I'm going for. And I think a lot depends upon in the use of material, and whether it's the citations of diaries or anything else, on the intelligence of the person thinking about this material. I mean, what is fascinating, is in the discussion of both the in the media of both the Swire diary and the Channon diary, is these are events that have been very carefully pushed by publicity, which is, that's good. And as I said, Simon Hepper's a very distinguished historian, good historian. Nobody is really given enough attention. I thought the Economist was the best, where the Economist actually reflected a bit on it and tried to contextualize it and said, well, doesn't this show how important Churchill was for, as it were, keeping these people at bay? Mm. And I think that is I thought the Economist account was a very intelligent one, and it was written, in fact, by somebody who is a historian and has got a history PhD and is a published historian, not me, I hasten to add. And I thought, good for him. I say good for him, I know who wrote it. But the on the whole, it has to be said that the treatment in the press was amazingly shallow, in that it didn't contextualise these figures adequately and didn't explain their essential irrelevance.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I think that, if you're looking, you asked me about political diaries. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at non-political diaries, then that's fine. If what you want, that's what you asked me about. If what you want is a diarist for a period, then it's very interesting. I mean, it's useful for a diarist of the 1930s, somebody of, shall we say, relatively humble background, to tell you about the impact of electricity coming through and what electricity meant in terms of heating, what it meant in terms of lighting, what it meant in terms of food storage. That is a useful thing, and in fact, in many senses, considerably more important to the spread of electricity and its impact on life than a lot of what people write about in the... it's one of the reasons, in fact, the 1930s life was getting better for a lot of people. But if you asked me specifically about political diaries, and, I tell you something that might interest you. When I was at Durham in the early 90s, I wrote to all the MPs who were going to stand down in the 1992 general election across the country, and all the northeastern MPs, and I asked them if they would like to deposit their papers in the university library at Durham, and that we would guarantee to obviously pay the cost of transporting them, cataloguing them, and keep them closed for as long as they liked. And I asked whether they were keeping a diary, among other things. Only one MP, that was Giles Radici, said, he was the MP for Chester the Street, one of the local MPs, said that he was keeping a diary. Everybody else said they weren't. And his has been published since. Now, I mean, I don't mean any discourtesy to Giles Radici, but he wasn't, and his diary isn't the leading source for the period. And I think it's fair to say that the many MPs who weren't keeping diaries, but, were keeping correspondence or were, producing, many of them, because they were, ministers or had been ministers, their sources are more pertinent. They may be less interesting, or they may be less easy. I mean, maybe reading a diary is a lazy person's guide to the past, or let's rephrase that, a guide to the past for lazy people, because it gives you a narrator, hopefully an interesting narrator, gives you a narrator, and as it were, it makes everything coherent through his or her perception. That's fine if that's what you want to read, literature on the past, absolutely fine, nothing wrong with that. But that isn't necessarily what you might regard as you, to use a phrase you used, the granulated nature of the past, the mess that is history.
Yes, well, just looking over the mess of history over the last 50, 60 years, I wonder if you could give an evaluation of which of the political diarists in Britain you think have been the most significant or the most overrated. I mean, one thinking of people like the Crossman Diaries and the Castle Diaries in the Wilson years, Alan Clark for the Thatcher years, Edwina Currie, lest we forget, for the 1990s.
Right. And, yeah. Right, that is the title of your next
and, Paddy Ashdown, Alistair Campbell, and so on. Which of these do you think have real value for historian, and which should we pass over?
Well, none of those do I think have any real value for historians. I suppose the Crossman Diary is the most interesting because he does try and engage with the nature of the relationship between minister and civil servant. But none of those are, I think, going to be in the long term as interesting as the hard work of going through ministerial and other correspondence. But obviously people don't want to do that. I mean, the average reader doesn't want to do that, so they will perforce go on reading these blockbuster works. But I personally don't think an enormous amount of them. I think political diaries are useful if the other sources are absent or limited. So I do think the Pepys Diary is useful. I do think the Harvey Diary is useful, whereas I don't think Horace Walpole was particularly useful. So I think if the material is absent, but for example, once you've got, you know, Charles Moore's three volumes on Thatcher, what on earth do you need to read Alan Clark for? What exactly is the point? I mean, if you want to get some salacious titillation, then read something that gives you salacious titillation. But what on earth is the point of reading Alan Clark once you've got Charles Moore? I mean, hopefully, I mean, Charles will summarise it, just as the late Angus Hawkins produced a one volume on his two volume Derby. Hopefully, Charles will produce a shorter work on his Thatcher. That would be marvellous. But I mean, that is what you really want, and it gives you much more of the flow and flair of history and the flow and flair of Margaret Thatcher than Alan Clark did.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we can be professional historians or the broader interested public, do you think that we've been misled by any of the major diarists, political diarists of the last century or more in how they have interpreted events which have then become an accepted wisdom which perhaps are not so wise?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. I do think actually Crossman was quite misleading in a way on the 1960s. But on the whole, I think this sounds terrible given that we're both writers. I think that these are generally books that are purchased. They may well be read, but I don't think they make much of an impact. I really don't think they make much of an impact. And if you want to think of a diarist who you haven't mentioned on the 20th century, who incidentally has had two editions, the second one was greater than the first. Now, somebody who was important, and that's Alan Brooke, his wartime diary, the second edition by Alex Danchev, who alas died quite young and who I knew, that is a significant work. I mean, again, we're talking about somebody who was chief of the Imperial General Staff, and it is very interesting. I mean, I remember being very struck by his entry for the April 9th, 1942. He's commenting on the report that 60,000 Japanese troops are en route for Sri Lanka. There's this sense of, this is an overreaction to what was a disastrous for Britain movement of the Japanese main strike force into the Bay of Bengal. I mean, there is this real sense you pick up there of the drama and problem affecting British policy making at that time, the simultaneity of things, the way in which you really do not know what going on, and you get a sense there of the nature of strategy. That, you know, one of my fields is strategy. I think I would recommend, if I was having to recommend any diarist of the mid 20th century to a reader, I would recommend Alan Brooke, because he's dealing, A, with something that is important, B, he knew about it, C, he did know everybody who counted, and D, he was writing it at the time. Now, compared to that, a lot of the others are just fluff.
Well, Professor Jeremy Black, with that recommendation for the Alan Brooke Diaries, we must leave it there. We'll be talking about archival research in a future edition of Black's History Week. But for your thoughts on political diaries, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.